The life timer of Imp stood in the middle of the huge desk. The Death of Rats walked around it, squeaking under his breath. Susan looked at it too. There was no doubt that all the sand was in the bottom bulb, but something else had filled the top and was pouring through the pinch. It was pale blue and coiling in frantically on itself like excited smoke. "Have you ever seen anything like it?" she said.
"Squeak."
"Nor me."
Susan stood up. The shadows around the walls, now that she'd got used to them, seemed to be of things. Not exactly machinery, but not exactly furniture either. There had been an orrery on the lawn at college. The distance shapes put her in mind of it, although what stars it measured and in what dark courses she really couldn't say. They seemed to be projections of things too strange even for this strange dimension. She'd wanted to save his life, and that was right, she knew it. As soon as she'd seen his name, she... Well, it wasn't important. She'd inherited some of Death's memory. She couldn't have met the boy, but perhaps he had. She felt that the name and the face had established themselves so deeply in her mind now that the rest of her thoughts were forced to orbit them. Something else had saved him first. She held the lifetimer up to her ear again. She found herself tapping her foot and realized that the distant shadows were moving. She ran across the floor, the real floor, the one outside the boundaries of the carpet. The shadows looked more like mathematics would be if it was solid. There were vast curves of something. Pointers like clock hands, but longer than a tree, moved slowly through the air. The Death of Rats climbed onto her shoulder. "I suppose you don't know what's happening?"
"Squeak."
Susan nodded. Rats, she supposed, died when they should. They didn't try to cheat or return from the dead. There were no such things as zombie rats. Rats knew when to give up. She looked at the glass again. The boy, and she used the term as girls will of young males several years older than them, the boy had played a chord on the guitar or whatever it was, and history had been bent, or had skipped or something. Something besides her didn't want him dead. It was 2 o'clock in the morning and raining. Constable Detritus, Ankh Morpork City Watch, was guarding the Opera House. It was an approach to policing that he'd picked up from Sergeant Colon. When you were all by yourself in the middle of a rainy night, go and guard something big with handy overhanging eaves. Colon had pursued this policy for years, as a result of which no major landmark had ever been stolen. Well, except for Unseen University once, but that was just a student prank. It had been an uneventful night. About an hour earlier, a 64-foot organ pipe had dropped out of the sky. Detritus had wandered over to inspect the crater, but he wasn't quite certain if this was criminal activity. Besides, for all he knew, this was how you got organ pipes. For the last 5 minutes, he'd also been hearing muffled thumps and the occasional tinkling noise from inside the opera house. He'd made a note of it. He did not wish to appear stupid. Detritus had never been inside the opera house. He didn't know what sound it normally made at 2 a.m. The front doors opened, and a large, oddly shaped, flat box came out hesitantly. It advanced in a curious way, a few steps forward, a couple of steps back. And it was also talking to itself. Detritus looked down. He could see, he paused, at least 7 legs of various sizes, only 4 of which had feet. He shambled across to the box and banged on the side.
"Hello! Hello! What's all this, then?"
he said, concentrating to get the sentence right. The box stopped. Then it said,
"We're a piano."
Detritus gave this due consideration. He wasn't sure what a piano was.
Piano move about, does it?"
he said.
We've got legs," said the piano.
Detritus conceded the point.
"But it are the middle of the night," he said.
"Even pianos have to have time off," said the piano.
Detritus scratched his head. This seemed to cover it.
"Well, all right,"
he said. He watched the piano jerk and wobble down the marble steps and round the corner. It carried on talking to itself.
"How long have we got, do you think? We ought to make it to the bridge. He's not clever enough to be a drummer. But he's a policeman. So?
Cliff?
Yep. We might get caught.
He can't stop us. We're on a mission from God."
"Right."
The piano tottered onward through the puddles for a little while, and then asked itself,
"Buddy?"
"Yep."
"Why did I just say that?"
"Say what?"
"About us being on a mission, you know, from God."
Well, the dwarf said to us, go and get the piano, and his name is Glod, so...
Yeah, yeah, right, right. But he could have stopped us. I mean, there's nothing special about some mission from some dwarf.
Maybe you were just a bit tired.
Maybe that's it, said the piano gratefully.
Anyway, we are on a mission from Glod.
Yep. Glod sat in his lodgings watching the guitar. It had stopped playing when Buddy had gone out, although if he put his ear close to the strings, he was sure that they were still humming very gently. Now, he very carefully reached out and touched the... To call the sudden snapping sound discordant would be too mild. The sound had a snarl. It had talons. Glod sat back. Right, right. It was Buddy's instrument. An instrument played by the same person over the years could become very adapted to them, although not in Glod's experience to the point of biting someone else. Buddy hadn't had it a day yet, but the principle, maybe, was the same. It was an old dwarf legend about the famous Horn of Fergal, which sounded itself when danger was near, and also in the presence, for some reason, of horseradish. And there was even an Ankh Morpork legend, wasn't there, about some old drum in the palace or somewhere that was supposed to bang itself if an enemy fleet was seen sailing up the Ankh? The legend had died out in recent centuries, partly because this was the Age of Reason, and also because no enemy fleet could sail up the Ankh without a gang of men with shovels going in front. And there was a troll story about some stones that on frosty nights... The point was that magical instruments turned up every so often. Glod reached out again. All right, all right. The old music shop was right up against the university, after all, and magic did leak out, despite what the wizards always said about talking rats and walking trees just being statistical flukes. But this didn't feel like magic. It felt a lot older than that. It felt like music. Glod wondered whether he should persuade Buddy to take it back to the shop and get a proper guitar. On the other hand, $6 was $6, at least. Something hammered on the door. Who's that? Said Glod, looking up. The pause outside was long enough to let him guess. He decided to help out. Cliff, he said.
Yep, got a piano here.
Bring it on in.
Had to break off the legs and the lid and a few other bits, but it's basically okay.
Bring it on in, then.
Door's too narrow.
Buddy, coming up the stairs behind the troll, heard the crunch of woodwork.
Try it again.
Fits perfectly.
There was a piano-shaped hole around the doorway. Glod was standing next to it, holding his axe. Buddy looked at the wreckage all over the landing.
What the hell are you doing? He said. That's someone else's wall.
Well, it's someone else's piano.
Yes, but you can't just hack holes in the wall.
What's more important, some wall or getting the sound right? Said Glod.
Buddy hesitated. Part of him thought, that's ridiculous, it's only music. Another part of him thought, rather more sharply, that's ridiculous, it's only a wall. All of him said,
oh, since you put it like that, but what about the piano player?
I told you, I know just where to find one, said Glod.
A tiny part of him was amazed. I've hacked a hole in my own wall. It took me days to nail that wallpaper on properly. Albert was in the stable with a shovel and a wheelbarrow.
Go well, he said when Susan's shadow appeared over the half-door.
Yes, I suppose.
Pleased to hear it, said Albert without looking up.
The shovel thumped on the barrow.
Only something happened which probably wasn't usual.
Sorry to hear that.
Albert picked up the wheelbarrow and trundled it in the direction of the garden. Susan knew what she was supposed to do. She was supposed to apologize, and then it'd turn out that crusty old Albert had a heart of gold, and they'd be friends after all, and he'd help her and tell her things, and she'd be some stupid girl who couldn't cope. No. She went back to the stable, where Binky was investigating the contents of a bucket. The Quirm College for Young Ladies encouraged self-reliance and logical thought. Her parents had sent her there for that reason. They'd assumed that insulating her from the fluffy edges of the world was the safest thing to do. In the circumstances, this was like not telling people about self-defense so that no one would ever attack them. Unseen University was used to eccentricity among the faculty. After all, humans derive their notions of what it means to be a normal human being by constant reference to the humans around them. and when those humans are other wizards, the spiral can only wiggle downwards. The librarian was an orangutan, and no one thought that that was at all odd. The reader in esoteric studies spent so much time reading in what the bursar referred to as the smallest room that he was generally referred to as the reader in the lavatory, even on official documents. The smallest room in Unseen University is in fact a broom cupboard on the fourth floor. He really meant the privy. The reader had a theory that all the really good books in any building, at least all the really funny ones, the ones with cartoons about cows and dogs, and captions like, "As soon as he saw the duck, Elmer knew it was going to be a bad day," gravitate to a pile in the privy, but no one ever has time to read all of them, or even knows how they came to be there. His research was causing extreme constipation and a queue outside the door every morning. The bursar himself, in any normal society, would have been considered more unglued than a used stamp in a downpour. The dean had spent 17 years writing a treatise on the use of the syllable enk in levitation spells of the early confused period. The Arch-Chancellor, who regularly used the long gallery above the Great Hall for archery practice, and had accidentally shot the bursar twice, thought the whole faculty was as crazy as loons, whatever a loon was. "Not enough fresh air," he'd say. "Too much sitting around indoors rots the brain." More often he'd say, "Duck!" None of them, apart from Ridcully and the librarian, were early risers. Breakfast, if it happened at all, happened around mid-morning. Wizards lined the buffet, lifting the big silver lids of the tureens and wincing at every clang. Ridcully liked big, greasy breakfasts, especially if they included those slightly translucent sausages with the green flecks that you can only hope is a herb of some sort. Since it was the Arch-Chancellor's prerogative to choose the menu, many of the more squeamish wizards had stopped eating breakfast altogether and got through the day just on lunch, tea, dinner and supper, and the occasional snack. So there weren't too many in the Great Hall this morning. Besides, it was a bit drafty. Workmen were busy somewhere up on the roof. Ridcully put down his fork.
"All right. Who's doing it?" he said. "Own up, that man."
"Doing what, Arch-Chancellor?" said the senior wrangler.
"Someone's tapping his foot."
The wizards looked along the table. The dean was staring happily into space.
"Dean," said the senior wrangler.
The dean's left hand was held not far from his mouth. The other was making rhythmic stroking motions somewhere in the region of his kidneys.
"I don't know what he thinks he's doing," said Ridcully, "but it looks unhygienic to me. I think he's playing an invisible banjo, Arch-Chancellor," said the lecturer in recent runes. "Well, it's quiet, at least," said Ridcully.
He looked at the hole in the roof, which was letting unaccustomed daylight into the hall.
"Anyone seen the librarian?"
The orangutan was busy. He had holed up in one of the library cellars, which he currently used as a general workshop and book hospital. There were various presses and guillotines, a bench full of tins of nasty substances where he made his own binding glue, and all the other tedious cosmetics of the muse of literature. He'd brought a book down with them. It had taken even him several hours to find it. The library didn't only contain magical books, the ones which are chained to their shelves and are very dangerous. It also contained perfectly ordinary books printed on commonplace paper in mundane ink. It would be a mistake to think that they weren't also dangerous, just because reading them didn't make fireworks go off in the sky. Reading them sometimes did the more dangerous trick of making fireworks go off in the privacy of the reader's brain. For example, the big volume open in front of him contained some of the collected drawings of Leonard of Quirm, skilled artist and certified genius with a mind that wandered so much it came back with souvenirs. Leonard's books were full of sketches, of kittens, of the way water flows, of the wives of influential Ankh-Morpokian merchants whose portraits have provided his means of making a living. But Leonard had been a genius and was deeply sensitive to the wonders of the world, so the margins were full of detailed doodles of whatever was on his mind at that moment. Vast water-powered engines for bringing down city walls on the heads of the enemy, new types of siege guns for pumping flaming oil over the enemy, gunpowder rockets that showered the enemy with burning phosphorus, and other manufactures of the Age of Reason. And there had been something else. The librarian had noticed it in passing once before, and had been slightly puzzled by it. It seemed out of place, and didn't appear to do anything to the enemy at all. His hairy hand thumbed through the pages. Ah, here it was. Yes. Ah, yes. It spoke to him in the language of the beat. The Arch-Chancellor made himself comfortable at his snooker table. He'd long ago got rid of the official desk. A snooker table was much to be preferred. Things didn't fall off the edge. There were a number of handy pockets to keep sweets and things in, and when he was bored, he could shovel the paperwork off and set up trick shots. He was a wizard. Trick shots for a wizard aren't the old three-times-round-the-table jobs. His best one was once off the cushion, once off a seagull, once off the back of the head of the bursar who'd been walking along the corridor outside last Tuesday. A bit of a temporal spin there. And a tricky rebound off the ceiling. He'd missed sinking the actual shot by a whisker, but it had been pretty tricky, even so. He never bothered to shovel the paperwork back on afterwards. In his experience, anything really important never got written down, because by then people were too busy shouting. He picked up his pen and started to write. He was composing his memoirs. He'd got as far as the title. Along the Ankh, with bow, rod, and staff with a knob on the end. Not many people realize, he wrote, that the River Ankh has a large and varied Piscine population. And this was true. Nature can adapt to practically anything. There were fish evolved to live in the river. They looked like a cross between a soft-shelled crab and an industrial vacuum cleaner, and tended to explode in fresh water. And what you had to use for bait was nobody's business. But they were fish, and a sportsman like Ridcully never cared about what the quarry tasted like. He flung down the pen and stormed along the corridor into the dean's office. "What the hell's that?" he shouted. The dean jumped. "It's a guitar, Arch-Chancellor," said the dean, walking hurriedly backwards as Ridcully approached. "I just bought it. I can see that. I can hear that. What was it you were trying to do?" "I was practicing, riffs," said the Dean. He waved a badly printed woodcut defensively in Ridcully's face. The Arch-Chancellor grabbed it. "Blurt Weedown's Guitar Primer," he read. "Play your way to success in 3 easy leftsons and 18 hard leftsons. Well, I've nothing against guitars, pleasant airs, espying young maidens one morning in May and so on, but that wasn't playing, that was just noise. I mean, what was it supposed to be?" "A lick based on an E pentatonic scale using the major seventh as a passing tone," said the Dean. The Arch-Chancellor peered at the open page. "But this says, Lesson 1, Fairy Footsteps," he said. I was getting a bit impatient," said the Dean. "You've never been musical, Dean," said Ridcully. "It's one of your good points. Why the sudden inch... What have you got on your feet?" The Dean looked down. "I thought you were a bit taller," said Ridcully. "You standing on a couple of planks?" "They're just... thick soles," said the Dean. Just something the dwarfs invented, I suppose. I don't know, I found them in my closet. Modo, the gardener, says he thinks they're crepe." "That's strong language for Modo, but I'd say he's right enough." "No, it's a kind of rubbery stuff," said the Dean dismally.
Excuse me, Arch-Chancellor?"
It was the bursar standing in the doorway. A large red-faced man was behind him, craning over his shoulder.
"What is it, bursar?"
This gentleman has got a..."
"It's about your monkey," said the man.
Ridcully brightened up.
"Oh, yes. Apparently, he removed some wheels from this gentleman's carriage," said the bursar, who was on the depressive side of his mental cycle.
"You sure it was the librarian?" said the Arch-Chancellor.
"Fat, red hair, says ook a lot."
That's him. Oh, dear. I wonder why he did that," said Ridcully. "Still, you know what they say, a 500-pound gorilla can sleep where he likes."
"But a 300-pound monkey can give me my bloody wheels back," said the man, unmoved. "If I don't get my wheels back, there's going to be trouble."
Trouble?" said Ridcully.
"Yeah. And don't think you can scare me. Wizards don't scare me. Everyone knows there's a rule that you mustn't use magic against civilians."
The man thrust his face close to Ridcully and raised a fist. Ridcully snapped his fingers. There was an inrush of air and a croak.
I've always thought of it more as a guideline, he said, mildly. Bursar, go and put this frog in the flowerbed, and when he becomes his old self, give him $10. $10 would be all right, wouldn't it?
Croak, said the frog, hastily.
Good. And now, will someone tell me what's going on?
There was a series of crashes from downstairs.
Why do I think, said Ridcully to the world in general, that this isn't going to be the answer?
The servants had been laying the tables for lunch. This generally took some time. Since wizards took their meals seriously and left a lot of mess, the tables were in a permanent state of being laid, cleaned, or occupied. Place settings alone took a lot of time. Each wizard required 9 knives, 13 forks, 12 spoons, and 1 rammer, quite apart from all the wine glasses. Wizards often turned up in ample time for the next meal. In fact, they were often there in good time to have second helpings of the last one. A wizard was sitting there now.
That's recent runes, ain't it? Said Ridcully.
He had a knife in each hand. He also had the salt, pepper and mustard pots in front of him, and the cake stand, and a couple of tureen covers, all of which he was hitting vigorously with the knives.
What's he doing that for? Said Ridcully. And Dean, will you stop tapping your feet?
Well, it's catchy, said the Dean.
It's catching, said Ridcully.
The lecturer in recent runes was frowning in concentration. Forks jangled across the woodwork, a spoon caught a glancing blow, pinwheeled through the air and hit the bursar on the ear.
What the hells does he think he's doing?
That really hurt.
The wizards clustered around the lecturer in recent runes. He paid them no attention whatsoever. Sweat poured down his beard.
He just broke the cruet, said Ridcully.
It's going to smart for hours.
Ah, yes, he's as hot as mustard, said the Dean.
I'd take that with a pinch of salt, said the senior wrangler.
Ridcully straightened up. He raised a hand.
Now someone's about to say something like, I hope the watch don't catch up with him, aren't you? He said. Or, that's a bit of a sauce. Or, I bet you're all trying to think of something silly to say about pepper. I'd just like to know what's the difference between this faculty and a bunch of pea-brained idiots.
Ha, ha, ha,
said the bursar nervously, still rubbing his ear.
It wasn't a rhetorical question.
Ridcully snatched the knives out of the lecturer's hands. The man went on beating the air for a moment and then appeared to wake up.
Hello, Arch-Chancellor. Is there a problem?
What are you doing?
The lecturer looked down at the table.
He was syncopating, said the Dean. I never was.
Ridcully frowned. He was a thick-skinned, single-minded man, with the tact of a sledgehammer and about the same sense of humour, but he was not stupid, and he knew that wizards were like weather vanes, or the canaries that miners used to detect pockets of gas. They were, by their nature, tuned to an occult frequency. If there was anything strange happening, it tended to happen to wizards. They turned, as it were, to face it, or dropped off their perch.
"Why is everyone suddenly so musical?" he said, using the term in its loosest sense, of course.
He looked at the assembled wizardry, and then down towards the floor.
"You've all got crepe on your shoes."
The wizards looked at their feet with some surprise.
"My word, I thought I was a bit taller," said the senior wrangler. "I put it down to the celery diet."
The senior wrangler had a theory that long food, beans, celery and rhubarb, made you taller because of the famous doctrine of signatures. It certainly made him lighter.
"Proper footwear for a wizard is pointy shoes or good stout boots," said Ridcully. "When one's footwear turns creepy, something's amiss."
"It's crepe," said the Dean. "It's got a little pointy thingy over the..."
Ridcully breathed heavily.
"When your boots change by themselves," he growled.
"There's magic afoot?"
"Ha, ha, ha. Good one, senior wrangler," said the Dean.
"I want to know what's going on," said Ridcully in a low and level voice, "and if you don't all shut up, there will be trouble."
He reached into the pockets of his robe, and after a few false starts, produced a pocket thaumometer. He held it up. There was always a high level of background magic in the university, but the little needle was on the normal mark, on average, anyway. It was ticking backwards and forwards across it like a metronome. Aridcully held it up so they could all see. "What's this?" he said.
"4-4 time," said the Dean.
"Music ain't magic," said Ridcully. "Don't be daft. Music's just, twanging and banging and—" He stopped.
"Has anyone got anything they should be telling me?"
The wizards shuffled their blue suede feet nervously.
"Well," said the senior wrangler, "it is a fact that last night, that is to say, some of us, happened to be passing by the, mended drum."
"Bona fide travellers," said the lecturer in recent rooms. "It's allowable for bona fide travellers to get a drink at licensed premises at any hour of day or night. City statute, you know."
"Where were you travelling from, then?" Ridcully demanded.
The bunch of grapes."
"That's just around the corner."
"Yes, but we were tired."
All right, said Ridcully, in the voice of a man who knows that pulling at a thread any more will cause the whole vest to unravel.
"The librarian was with you?"
"Oh, yes."
"Go on."
"Well, there was this music."
"Sort of twangy," said the senior wrangler. "Melody-led," said the Dean.
"It was sort of, in a way, it
kind of gets under your skin and makes you feel fizzy," said the Dean. "Incidentally, has anyone got any black paint? I've looked everywhere."
"Under your skin," murmured Ridcully. He scratched his chin. "Oh, dear, one of those. Stuff leaking into the universe again, eh? Influences coming from outside, yes? Remember what happened when Mr. Hong opened his takeaway fish bar on the site of the old temple in Dagon Street? And then there were those moving pictures. I was against them from the start. All those wire things on wheels. This universe has more damn holes in it than a quirm cheese.
Well, it's Lankra cheese," said the senior wrangler, helpfully. "That's the one with holes. Quirm is the one with the blue veins."
Ridcully gave him a look.
"Actually, it didn't feel magical," said the Dean.
He sighed. He was 72. It had made him feel that he was 17 again. He couldn't remember having been 17. It was something that must have happened to him while he was busy. But it made him feel like he imagined it felt like when you were 17, which was like having a permanent red-hot vest on under your skin. He wanted to hear it again.
"I think they're going to have it again tonight," he ventured. "We could go along and listen in order to learn more about it, in case it's a threat to society," he added virtuously.
That's right, Dean," said the lecturer in recent rooms. It's our civic duty. We're the city's first line of supernatural defence. Supposing ghastly creatures started coming out of the air."
"What about it?" said the chair of indefinite studies.
"Well, we'd be there."
"Yes, that's good, is it?"
Ridcully glared at his wizards. Two of them were surreptitiously tapping their feet, and several of them appeared to be twitching very gently. The bursar twitched gently all the time, of course, but that was only his way. "Like canaries," he thought, "or lightning conductors."
"All right," he said reluctantly, "we'll go, but we won't draw attention to ourselves."
"Certainly, Arch-Chancellor."
"And everyone's to buy their own drink."
"Oh."
Corporal, possibly Cotton, saluted in front of the fort sergeant, who was trying to shave.
"It's the new recruit, sir," he said. "He won't obey orders."
The sergeant nodded and then looked blankly at something in his own hand.
"Razor, sir," said the corporal helpfully. "He just keeps on saying things like, 'It's not happening yet.'"
"Have you tried burying him up to his neck in sand? That usually works."
"It's a bit, nasty to people. Oh, had it a moment ago.
The corporal snapped his fingers.
Cruel, that's it. We don't give people the pit these days."
"This is the..."
The sergeant glanced at the palm of his left hand, where there were several lines of writing.
The Foreign Legion."
"Yes, sir. All right, sir. He's weird. He just sits there all the time. We call him Bo Nidal, sir."
The sergeant peered bemusedly at the mirror.
It is your face, sir," said the corporal.
Susan stared at herself critically. Susan. It wasn't a good name, was it? It wasn't a truly bad name. It wasn't like poor old Iodine in the fourth form, or Nigella, a name which means, oops, we wanted a boy. But it was dull. Susan. Sue. Good old Sue. It was a name that made sandwiches, kept its head in difficult circumstances, and could reliably look after other people's children. It was a name used by no queens or goddesses anywhere. And you couldn't do much even with the spelling. You could turn it into Susie, and it sounded as though you danced on tables for a living. You could put in a Z and a couple of N's and an E, but it still looked like a name with extensions built on. It was as bad as Sarah, a name that cried out for a prosthetic H. Well, at least she could do something about the way she looked. It was the robe. It might be traditional, but she wasn't. The alternative was her school uniform, or one of her mother's pink creations. The baggy dress of the Quirm College for Young Ladies was a proud one, and in the mind of Miss Butts, at least, proof against all the temptations of the flesh. But it lacked a certain panache as a costume for the ultimate reality, and pink was not even to be thought of. For the first time in the history of the universe, a death wondered about what to wear.
"Hold on," she said to her reflection. "Here, I can create things, can't I?"
She held out her hand and thought, "Cup." A cup appeared. It had a skull and bones pattern around the rim.
"Ah," said Susan, "I suppose a pattern of roses is out of the question. Probably not right for the ambience, I expect."
She put the cup on the dressing table and tapped it. It went plink in a solid sort of way.
"Well then," she said, "I don't want something soppy and posy. No silly black lace or anything worn by idiots who write poetry in their rooms and dress like vampires and are vegetarians, really."
The images of clothes floated across her reflection. It was clear that black was the only option, but she settled on something practical and without frills. She put her head on one side critically.
Well, maybe a bit of lace," she said, "and perhaps a bit more bodice."
She nodded at her reflection in the mirror. Certainly it was a dress that no Susan would ever wear, although she suspected that there was a basic Susan-ness about her which would permeate it after a while.
"It's a good job you're here," she said, "or I'd go totally mad."
Then she went to see her grandfather, Death. There was one place he had to be. Glod wandered quietly into the university library. Dwarfs respected learning, provided they didn't have to experience it. He tugged at the robe of a passing young wizard.
"There's a monkey runs this place, right?" he said. "Big, fat, hairy monkey, hands a couple of octaves wide."
The wizard, a pasty-faced postgraduate student, looked down at Glod with the disdainful air a certain type of person always reserves for dwarfs. It wasn't much fun being a student in Unseen University. You had to find your pleasures where you could. He grinned a big, wide, innocent grin.
"Why, yes," he said. "I do believe right at this moment he's in his workroom in the basement. But you have to be very careful how you address him."
"Is that so?" said Glod.
"Yes, you have to be sure to say, 'Do you want a peanut, Mr. Monkey?'"
said the student wizard. He signalled a couple of his colleagues.
"That's so, isn't it? He has to say, 'Mr. Monkey.'"
Oh, yes indeed, he," said a student. "Actually, if you don't want him to get annoyed, it's best to be on the safe side and scratch under your arms. That puts him at his ease."
And go, "Ugh, ugh, ugh," said a third student. "He likes that."
Well, thank you very much," said Glod. "Which way do I go?"
"We'll show you," said the first student.
"That's so very kind.
Don't mention it. Only too glad to help."
The three wizards led Glod down a flight of steps and into a tunnel. Light filtered down through the occasional pane of green glass set in the floor above. Every so often, Glod heard a snigger behind him. The librarian was squatting down on the floor in a long, high cellar. Miscellaneous items had been scattered on the floor in front of him. There was a cartwheel, odd bits of wood and bone, and various pipes, rods, and lengths of wire that somehow suggested that around the city people were puzzling over broken pumps and fences with holes in. The librarian was chewing the end of a piece of pipe and looking intently at the heap.
"That's him," said one of the wizards, giving Glod a push.
The dwarf shuffled forward. There was another outburst of muffled giggling behind him. He tapped the librarian on the shoulder.
"Excuse me."
"Ooh?"
Those guys just called you a monkey, said Glod, jerking a thumb in the direction of the door. I'd make them say sorry if I was you. There was a creaking metallic noise, followed very closely by a scuffling outside as the wizards trampled one another in their effort to get away. The librarian had bent the pipe into a U-shape, apparently without effort. Glod went to the door and looked out. There was a pointy hat on the flagstones, trampled flat. That was fun, he said. If I'd just asked them where the librarian was, they'd have said, bugger off, you dwarf. You have to know how to deal with people in this game. He came back and sat down beside the librarian. The ape put a smaller bend in the pipe. What are you making? Said Glod.
Ook, 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 ook.
My cousin Modo is the gardener here, said Glod. He says you're a mean keyboard player. He stared at the hands busy in the pipe bending. They were big. And of course, there were four of them. He was certainly partly right, he added. The ape picked up a length of driftwood and tasted it. We thought you might like to play pianoforte with us at the drum tonight, said Glod. Me and Cliff and Buddy, that is. The librarian rolled a brown eye towards him, then picked up a piece of wood, gripped one end, and began to strum.
Hook?
That's right, said Glod. The boy with the guitar.
Hook, hook, hook.
The librarian did a back somersault.
Hook, 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 hook.
I can see you're in the swing of it already, said Glod. Susan saddled the horse and mounted up. Beyond Death's garden were fields of corn, their golden sheen the only colour in the landscape. Death might not have been any good at grass, black, and apple trees, gloss black on black, but all the depth of colour he hadn't put elsewhere he'd put in the fields. They rippled as if in the wind, except that there wasn't any wind. Susan couldn't imagine why he'd done it. There was a path, though. It led across the fields for half a mile or so, then disappeared abruptly. It looked as though somebody walked out here occasionally and just stood, looking around. Binky followed the path and stopped at the end. Then he turned, managing not to disturb a single ear.
I don't know how you do this, Susan whispered, but you must be able to do it, and you know where I want to go.
The horse appeared to nod. Albert had said that Binky was a genuine flesh-and-blood horse, but maybe you could be ridden by death for hundreds of years without learning something. He looked as though he'd been pretty bright to start with. Binky began to trot, and then canter, and then gallop, and then the sky flickered just once. Susan had expected more than that, flashing stars, some sort of explosion of rainbow colours, not just a flicker. It seemed a rather dismissive way of travelling nearly 17 years. The cornfields had gone, but the garden was pretty much the same. There was the strange topiary, and the pond with the skeletal fish. There were, pushing jolly wheelbarrows and carrying tiny scythes, what might have been garden gnomes in a mortal garden, but here were cheery little skeletons in black robes. Things tended not to change. The stables were a little different, though. Binky was in them for a start. He whinnied quietly as Susan led him into an empty stall next to himself. "I'm sure you two know each other," she said. She'd never expected it to work. But it had to, didn't it? Time was something that happened to other people, wasn't it? She slipped into the house.